We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hello, Dragonfly Nation. It's the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast with your host, Caleb Musgrave, and my very special guest, Ryan the Adventure Guy. We got him hostage down here still. We're hopefully holding throughout the winter. It's getting cold down here, so I'm going to have to get him a heater, maybe another wool blankie.
Yeah, preferably like merino wool or something.
Merino wool, something a little warmer? Okay. Let's see how it is.
Bougie like that.
He's getting bougie on me. Ever since his name started getting out there in the podcast world, he's getting all, you know, too uppity for me now.
I have all of, what, like 550 followers on Instagram, so I'm kind of a big deal.
That's a big deal. This episode is our final episode of November, except for right after this episode is our bonus episode that we're doing for our patrons. They get to decide one episode a month, and that's our bonus episode we toss out. So actually you get 5 episodes a month from us now, as we have been doing since October. And that one will be Wild Game Recipe. So look forward to that one coming out right after this one. But before we get to the recipes, you know, we've talked about waterfowl hunting. We've talked about the ethics of hunting. We've talked about intro to hunting, like the primer of like what you need to know, what you need to get. And we've even done one episode on whitetail deer hunting. With all of that, a few of you may have gone out there and gone hunting this year. And some of you may have even been lucky enough to get an animal. And of course, deer season, the gun season just ended. Bow season is back up and running. Muzzle loaders coming up this coming week, I believe, of this episode. I haven't actually looked, so you muzzle loaders out there, please don't get too angry at me. You only got one shot anyways at me. But we have a few more weeks to go of the season. I figure this would be a good time to kind of talk about like what can you do with it all. Once you've killed an animal, whether it's a small animal or a big animal, whether it's a squirrel or a moose, trying to go back to Rocky and Bullwinkle there. But once you have that animal, what do you do with it all? What the hell do you do with this whole carcass, this whole corpse that you've created? And we figured we'd talk about that. We kind of break it down piece by piece, talk about the meat, the fat, the bones, the hides, the antler, the organs, everything in total. Like, what can you do with every part of this animal, both for food and for resources beyond food? And so that's what this episode's all about. So we're going to be breaking it down piece by piece. Rye has not gone out hunting yet, but he's getting his hunting license this coming New Year, I believe. In the New Year, you're receiving your training.
It's been postponed.
You were saying in December, got postponed to January, February.
December 18th to 20th, but now with the current change in lockdown precautions, it's January 17th.
Wash your hands, people. Wash your damn hands and socially distance so that Rye can get out there and get his hunting license, for crying out loud.
I can make some political jokes right now. I'll avoid that.
We'll avoid that.
So avoid the right being mad at me.
Uh-huh. Screw the right. We've gotten them mad at us enough times in the past on this show. I don't care.
They're the reason why this lefty can't get their hunting license.
You want more people with guns, this lefty's trying to get a gun.
I'm more centrist, but I'm left-leaning.
So, yeah.
Because I care about humans.
Exactly. Strange that. Anyways, that'll get rid of a few viewers. But now that the rest of you are still sticking around, let's get into some actual like breakdown of what you can do with that animal. So the first thing that most hunters see when they drop the animal is, man, that's a lot of meat. And they're right. There's a lot more meat in there than actually a lot of hunters take with them. And that's – I don't want to say a lot of hunters. I see a lot of really, really well – thought out hunters that are trying to take every piece of morsel they can, but they may not be aware of everything that's edible on an animal. So yes, you have your steaks and your roasts and your specialty cuts all over the carcass of every bone you can take meat off of, but there's also edible organs or edible viscera, such as your heart, your lungs. I'm not saying your heart, your lungs, the heart, the lungs. Don't eat yourself. That's the first thing. The first safety tip of the night I want to say right now is don't eat yourself. But the heart, the lungs, you're also looking at like the kidneys, though I'm personally not a fan of kidney. I will still cut it out and dehydrate that into dog treats for my dog Sushi, because even though I don't like it, she loves it. Liver, the same thing. If you don't like liver, still take it. If you got a dog, they will love you forever and their breath will stink forever. If you have a goose or another large bird, in this situation, probably just a turkey, but even ducks and grouse, they will have gizzards. And they will have all these little giblets that you can cut out of them, out of the organs, and cook up. And that includes heart, liver, the gizzard itself that you're going to have to clean and pull the plate off, the cartilage off of. It's a really cool little organ that has a real strong flavor, but it's a really good flavor, in my opinion. But again, if you don't like it, serve it to the dog. There's a lot of meat in there that if you're not a fan of it, the dog will be a very big fan of it. Our old dog, Highway, rest in peace, buddy. I miss you, man. His favorite thing was when I came home with a trachea from a deer, from a windpipe of a deer or a moose. And you would hear him until really the cows come home just in the dark, just crunch, 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 just chewing away at it. So edible viscera of every kind. And that includes things like eyeballs and the brain. Not all animals you want to be consuming the brain from. If you're going to be worrying about things like chronic waste and disease, you may want to avoid the brain altogether because that's where it really shows its strength. And that's the same thing with like Kurdu and Jakob, I'm not even going to get in there, but basically the prions, those diseases that are pretty much incurable that come along from eating the wrong things on the wrong animals or beings. That edible viscera, but also even the hide, like, if you have to, you can cook and eat the hide of an animal. And like,
I'll be talking about this during my Donner party.
You will be, yes. This coming December, we got a special, we're talking about survival stories of wintertime. And one of them is the Donner party that Ryan has been doing a lot of research on and prep work to make it pretty epic. But look, when people say like, you can eat the hide. Yeah, you can eat the hide, knucklehead. Like, look at turkeys. At Thanksgiving, the skin is one of the best cuts on that, best parts of that animal. Cracklings on a pig, that is skin. That is skin. You can cook that up and eat it. On a deer or a moose, what you can do is roast the hide on the inside only. Just basically expose that to the fire nearby and scrape all that beautiful, like, marbled meat up off the hide and cook that, basically chow down on that. But also, like, cooking with the hide. You look at traditional plains, indigenous people, like the Assiniboine people, were making pits in the ground, laying the hide of a buffalo or an elk inside there, pegging it down with stakes or rocks on the sides, and then filling that with water and dropping hot rocks inside, hot, clean rocks. You don't want to be adding much of grit. You don't want to be adding much of ash to it, but a little bit of hot rocks that are keep it cooking, and that becomes a stew base that you can start adding other things into, like prairie potato, prairie parsnip, all those kinds of things. There's a lot of great pieces of morsels on the inside of that hide that we can be cooking up. So for food alone, there's a ton going on, not just the meat itself, but the organs. And like, do your damnedest to get every scrap of meat you can off that animal. Even if you don't think you'll eat it, you can pass it on to your dog. You can pass it on to your neighbor's dog. You can pass it on to your friends who may like those cuts of the animal. One of my favorite things to do is to find out neighbors who like unique pieces of animals and make sure they get those cuts. Like, my grandmother loves the back end of muskrats. Like the hindquarters of a muskrat. She absolutely loves those. Whereas her cousin likes the feet. They like to chew on the feet of all things after they've been roasted. Sounds weird, I know, but that's what they like. Same with beaver. They actually really like roasting beaver feet, scraping the hair off, roasting the feet up, and chewing on that, kind of like we chew on chicken wings, in a sense. Sounds really weird, I know, but apparently it tastes great. I haven't had a chance to try it myself. But there's a lot of beautiful edible parts and portions on an animal. So do your best to collect them all. A lot of hunters will leave ribs behind because the ribs on a deer, frankly, don't taste that great. You can bone it out and turn that into grind. Make that into your venison burger. If you really don't like the fat content, you can take most of the fat off and pressure cook the deer or slow cook it and then finish it on the barbecue afterwards with some sloppy barbecue sauce to make it taste better. There's a lot of ways to make it taste good. We'll be talking about that in the next episode. But really, like, at the end of the day, we're into hunting to get the meat. So get all the meat you can. Don't waste any of it.
So one of the things that comes to my mind that I want to ask about first is, like, what is your first step or process once you successfully got your animal?
And this is the beauty of having you on the show, because I completely forgot about answering this kind of a question first. I just dove right into it. Like, let's get into this. Once you have an animal, whether it's an animal you killed or an animal that got trapped or an animal that maybe got hit by a car that you want to turn into meat, you have to break it down. You have to feel the proper term that most people use is field dressing. Other people call it gutting or gutting. And it's one of the major things, like, from the moment you kill the animal, the animal dies. From that moment onward, it is going to try and rot. It's going to try and become gross,
yeah,
and go back to the land. And so we have to inhibit that every step we can if we want to get the most bang for our buck. So gutting is one of the first things we've got to do. So when you get the animal, whether it's a male or female, not a lot changes. Like to some people, there's a lot of change there. But for us, just trying to get into that animal and pull all the organs out, there's not that much going on.
Do you hang it up on its side, or do you like hang it up in the air, or do you just lay it on its side? I've seen it multiple ways whenever I've seen shows.
And it depends on the person's preferences. Like with birds, I actually like to hang birds.
Yeah.
It's easier to pull all the guts out. There's like there's something to kind of anchor the animal down because you're going to be eventually reaching inside that body cavity and pulling the guts out.
Yeah.
So if you don't have it hung up by something or anchored down, you got to like hold onto the neck, and it sounds grotesque, but you got to yank.
Yeah.
Whereas with something like a moose or a deer, their own weight will hold them steady for you. It's kind of like when you're trying to split wood or chop a log or cut a log. If it's just free floating and it's big and heavy, not a big deal. But if it's a small piece of wood, it's helpful to have a buddy hold on to it kind of thing. Same kind of situation with the animals. It depends on the size of them. You can hang them and gut them if they're light enough. If it's a big animal like a deer or larger, you may want to just gut them right on the ground. Preferably with their head facing uphill is a lot more helpful because with the head facing uphill, the anus is facing downhill, and therefore when you start pulling all the organs out towards the anus, everything's going to go downhill and get out of the way.
Yeah.
And that can help you out a lot. But if you're on the side of a road or something with a car collision deer, you can gut it right there. Most police will ask you not to do that. They'll ask you to pack the whole animal up and get it out of there. And depending on how badly damaged it is, that may be pleasant or may not be pleasant.
It helps if you don't drive a Honda Civic.
Yes. Yes. If you don't, you know, completely obliterate the animal and of course have room in the car. Both of those are good tips. Drive a mid-sized vehicle for two reasons. A, you're not going to completely obliterate. And second off, you can fit the animal in the car.
Preferably pickup trucks.
Preferably pickup trucks.
Inside the same vicinity as you.
What's even better is if you're the one hitting the animal and you're in a pickup truck, they can land in the bed for you and you don't have to do any pickup.
Put a little plow on the front.
This is getting ridiculous. I love this. So the reason we have to remove the organs first is they're the ones that are going to start going bad first. They're going to spoil the fastest. Liver, all those types of organs are going to start to rot within a few hours to a few days, depending on the temperature and conditions of the organs. But also, like if you have something like the bladder and it's been ruptured, whether somebody gut shot the deer or they hit the turkey or what have you, if the bladder is ruptured, you now have urine inside the body cavity, and you got to get that out of there and clean up that body cavity as quickly as possible. Same thing with the gall, same thing with the intestines, especially for a non-herbivorous animal. So if you shoot a deer or you get a deer and you're gutting it and you cut open the intestines a little bit and some of the grass and other forbs and herbs that are in their stomach fall out onto the meat, not a big deal. It's a really big deal if you're gutting a bear. Because you can picture what bear poop is like. That's what's going to be getting on the inside of the body cavity. So you want to clean that out as quickly as possible. A, to prevent spoilage of the meat. B, to cool the body down. The cooler the meat is, the less likely it will spoil, even if you had a clean kill. Even if you didn't rupture any body organs other than the lungs and the heart, which are totally fine organs to rupture with your weapon, whether it's an arrow or a bullet. You don't want to, even if you have the cleanest kill there is, you want to get those organs out as fast as possible to cool the meat down. The whole animal has the same temperature as you, and bacteria love that temperature, or else we wouldn't be sick all the time. So we need to cool the corpse down. We need to cool the carcass. Two ways you can do that is gutting and skinning, taking the hide off afterwards. That depends on what kind of conditions you're in. If you're in really warm climate, let's say early bow season, like late September, early October kind of conditions. Or you get a warm spell like we did during gun season this year, where it went up to 22 degrees in the middle of the deer season for firearm hunters. You may want to take the hide off as well once you hang it up at home. When dragging it out of the bush, keep the hide on because that'll protect the meat from getting dirt and grit and rocks and whatnot. But once you get it back to your base camp or back to your hunting lodge or back to your actual home, hanging the animal by the neck and removing the hide from the neck down or from the anus up to the neck, depending on which way they want to go, is the next step to cool the body down. The reason I say it depends on the situation is you may want to leave that deer or that animal to hang for more than a day. Many of us probably have heard the terms like dry aged beef. Aging is part of the curing process where you allow the muscles to have a bacterial relaxation, basically. A chemical reaction happens in the muscle tissue after a certain amount of time, minimum 5 to 8 days, at around, let's say, 4 to 5 degrees Celsius. So you're still above freezing, but well below the temperature range where you have to worry about bacterial expansion and rot. That temperature, right around, I'd say 4 to maybe even up to 7 degrees, is optimal for letting it age for a couple of weeks. And if you leave the hide on, if you take the hide off and you leave it outside as getting rained on, first off, we shouldn't be hanging our deer where they can get rained on, or moose or any other animal. That's that water plus air meets bacteria equals rot. So the less we can allow that to happen and let it just be surrounded by dry, cool air, the better off it'll be. So some people leave the hide on to protect it from that. Other reasons they'll leave the hide on is to protect it from everything. Like, there's a bunch of different reasons why people do it. Everything from to keep bugs off of it all the way to, which again, like if it's warm enough that you're getting collecting bugs, you may just want to break it down and age it in the house or age it in a cool storage area or just break it down and cook it and just put it away. Or the other reason I've heard is everything from like, air breakdown to dogs. I'm not sure how hide will stop a dog from getting inside the deer cavity, like body cavity, and eating up whatever's in there, like the tenderloins and such. But people claim it helps protect it from dogs and other scavengers. All the way to, I've heard one guy say the UV rays will break down the meat and make it taste bad. I don't know if I believe that one, but I'm not sure if I believe most of those. So usually what I do is I skin them because I want them to be as cool as possible personally. And also the hide is a value to me. I want to use that hide to make it into smoked tan goods or maybe some raw hide for snowshoes or a drum or what have you. And I want to use as much of that animal as possible. So I'm not just going to leave it on there to eventually get so stiff and fat damaged that I can't use the hide. So I usually take the hide off the minute I get it hung up. And again, that's going to help cool it down, help preserve the meat in that sense, but also I'm going to be able to use the hide. And then from there, you're pretty much at the state of I can salt the hide or freeze the hide, and I've got this carcass hanging in the air. What I'll often do is when I'm hanging animals is I'll set up, if I can, depending on the hunt camp I'm at, we'll actually have like a sheltered location, like a, almost like a drive-in shed, like one of those pop-up Quonset hut things that people have for garages and stuff. We'll usually have one of those and have an actual rack built inside to hang all the meat in so it can have air circulation and yet it's not going to be out in the elements. Those are the main steps. Beyond that is how long do you want to age the meat? How long do you want to wait to cut it up? Maybe like you only have like a couple of days before everybody's got to go home and you don't want to pay a butcher to butcher it all up for you. Because there's a lot of horror stories of sending it to a butcher and getting like the wrong animal back. I've heard stories of that, like guys clearly like doing like a blood, like doing like quality control tests on butchers and them getting the wrong animal. Like they sent in a deer from like the Core of the Lakes area, specifically from this region. They got an actual like blood analysis of the deer. They end up getting ground beef or ground venison, everything back from the butcher. And they check and the deer was shot like south of Norwood. It's like clearly not the same deer at all. I don't really think it's a horror story. You're still getting the meat at the end of the day. But for me, it's more, I want to cut it up myself because I want to use every part of it. I want to cut up it and save the bone, save the antler, save the brain, save everything I can. Sending it to a butcher with the hide on everything, they usually just toss half of that stuff out and send you back ground venison, some pepperettes, and maybe a few steaks and roasts. I want to make sure I get everything I can out of the deer. And we're mostly talking about deer because it's the biggest one most Canadians are going to have. Some Canadians are in areas where they're able to go hunting moose, even better. Just extrapolate this into a larger animal. And pretty much deer are hunted all the way down into South America. So everybody who's listening should be able to get access to a deer if they're hunting or if they have a roadkill permit or what have you. So I'm going to stick to the deer analogy in this one. So we have the hide. And when we start the gut, when we start to dress the animal out, where you're going to start is pretty much just above the anus. And you're going to set the knife in. Your edge is going to be facing outward. Your knife is facing, your cutting edge is facing outward so that you're not cutting the hair and getting that hair onto any good meat. And then you're going to work your way up to the pelvis, up along the pelvis to the genitals, and you're going to cut around the genitals and basically ignore them for now. And then you're going to continue to make that incision all the way up the belly, making very certain you do not tip the tip of your knife downward and into the guts.
Yeah.
And then you're going to get up to the ribs. You're going to ride the ribs up kind of like a zipper. And then you're going to get up to the windpipe and the throat. And you're going to slice up along the windpipe, not cutting into the windpipe because, again, there's bacteria in there, up to the chin. And you can pretty much either cut right around the neck or cut right to the jawbone, depending on how you want to skin the animal you're skinning. If you're just trying to take the hide off, I usually just cut around the neck, and that's good enough for me, and I'll keep the head intact, and then or later on remove the brains and everything else and take the cheeks out and whatever, what have you. And then you're going to make incisions down to each hoof, and then you're going to cut around the ankle. And that's the first incisions, and really the only incisions you should be making. From there, you're then going to nick just below the belly at the pelvis. You're going to start opening up again. Now that you've gone all the way up, you're going to come back to the membrane. There's this thin membrane keeping the skin away from the organs. Like there's the same membrane that keeps the skin away from the meat, right? So we're going to peel that back, slice that away, and the organs are almost like pressurized. They're going to come plopping out real quickly. So you want to go real carefully. It's just going to take one little nick, and you can kind of tear the rest with your hands. A lot of people these days are getting really into nitrile gloves for this kind of work.
Yeah.
I'm kind of digging it myself, not because I'm like, ew, gross blood. I can't stand stuff under my nails. That's the main thing for me is I hate it. Like right now, my right finger, middle finger is driving me nuts because there's some dirt under my nail from when we were working in the woods today. And I haven't cleaned it out yet. It's bothering me. But we're going to pull that back, and the organs are going to start falling out. The lower digestive organs, like the intestines, the liver, the kidneys, all that stuff down there is going to start falling out. We kind of have a few options here because we also have to deal with the anus.
Yeah.
The anus is where all that stuff leads to. So if you go in, there's a lot of different products out there. There's a lot of different techniques. I come from a moose hunting family. And so our technique to do that is really fast and really kind of barbaric looking to a lot of people, but it works and it's fast and very clean. And I like the fact that it's efficient in my eyes. Some people use what's called a butt out, and it's this weird little pronged orange, frankly, butt plug looking thing that you drive into the anus and you twist it, and it basically grabs on the inside of the rectum. And when you pull it back out, it's kind of caught on there. And you can tie off and trim that area and slice that. And now the anus is completely tied off. And you can let it pop back through the body cavity of the pelvis cavity and connect that with the rest of the organs and kind of pick it all up as a bag and plop it out after you trim it off of the trachea with the same tying off thing. Other people will try to trim around the butthole with their knife. It's such a weird thing to talk about with you keeping a straight face right now. Trim around all the way around, and then they're going to pull it out a little bit and tie that off. And that's how my dad showed me how to do it as a kid, was you just take a little piece of cord, usually with a piece of like butcher twine you kept in your hunting bag, and just tied it off with a jam knot of some sort. And then again, it gets trimmed out and pushed through the pelvis back into the rest of the organs. But when I was about 13, I started watching the moose hunters in the family and how they process, because you're dealing with upwards of a 1,200 pound plus animal. And like in deer hunting world, like you can shoot a deer in the morning, take it back to camp after you field dress it, hang it up, and go back out and deer hunt again. Whereas when you go moose hunting, you kill one moose, the day's done. Maybe the next 2 days are done because it's such a big damn animal to work with. So you got to get things done quickly. So for a lot of what I just described, they started with a knife, but they finish it with a saw. So going along like the anus, when they get to the anus, the pelvis area, they literally will trim everything back, lift the pelvis up as best they can, and cut through the pelvis down to the anus. And then simply take a knife, scoop and cut the skin around the anus, tie it off like that, or not even tie it off altogether. They just simply pull it up and out of the body and drop it since they're facing it downhill as best they can. And any body fluids that are inside of the intestines and the butt are going to go flying out that way and away from the body. And if they time it properly, at the same time, the person up at the top has cut the trachea off, and they've also taken a saw and cut the rib cage open, and it just falls open, and now all the organs are exposed. Kind of like those, I don't want to say it this way because it sounds really like morbid, but almost like those dissection piglets in school that a lot of us felt uncomfortable doing, like myself.
Could we feed them like Lysol or bleach before they die to kind of clean out their insides?
Don't recommend.
Maybe we could have some of our doctors look at that idea. Is that a way to combat what we're facing in these days?
Oh, man. Those days are done. He's gone, man. We're good. We're safe now. We just got to deal with the other crazy guy.
Okay.
Oh, man.
The lesser of two evils.
The lesser, well, barely lesser. But yeah. So we take it basically with the moose hunter call technique. You're going to cut through the ribs with a saw, exposing all the organs from the diaphragm up to the organs that are from the diaphragm down. Then you're going to cut right at the throat, at the bottom of the chin, across the trachea, and you're going to start lifting the trachea and windpipe out. And if you have basically one person holding at each end and they're both done at the same time, they can pretty much lift all the organs out at once and drop it off to the side and get it out of the way. I've done that with a deer on my own with my buddy Paul McCarney. Hi, Paul, one of our first patrons, actually our very first patron on Patreon, one of our first supporters. Brother, love you. Paul can verify this. We were done in 2 minutes flat. I think we timed it like a minute and 45 seconds where I cut the trachea, went down and literally took my knife and drove it through the pelvic bone, flipped the knife over and just ripped through the ribs and then just grabbed the trachea and pulled everything downhill and all the organs just plopped right out in a nice clean pile. And there was very little cleanup to have to do afterwards. It's not always that easy. Organ, like gutting an animal can be very, very messy, especially with a larger animal because there's just a lot of blood. And when you shoot an animal with a rifle, you're causing hydrostatic shock, which means all the organs have gotten some shock to them. So there's gonna be a lot of bleeding. With an arrow, there's still gonna be a lot of bleeding. And so if you open up a moose, there could be like a gallon of blood just sitting in there. And like I've come home with my hunting pants that were my wool Big Bill pants that I've had before.
Yeah.
And I threw them in the bathtub to just rinse them off. And it took like 10 rinsings. And the bathtub still looked like a murder scene. Like there's just so much blood that sops up into your clothes when you're cleaning out of those. It's disgusting. My cousin once on our first moose hunt looked like Carrie in the scene from the movie Carrie. It looked like a prom scene. It was absolutely horrifying to see him in the dark walk up to you with the headlights of your ATV and you see this kid head to toe covered in blood. It was like a scene from a horror movie, 100%. So it's a lot of work, but it at the end of the day, you have all this edible organ, but also useful organs that are now been pulled out of the animal and you can now cool the body, clean the body. If there's been any ruptured organs, this is when you want to start cleaning it out. And you can clean it out by just taking buckets of water from the nearby creek and dousing it in there and wiping it out, or if it's a fairly clean kill, just wet paper towels, wiping it clean. No matter what, after you've applied water, you want to dry that animal out as best as possible. Because again, water plus temperature and bacteria and air equals rot. So a wet body will sometimes even put a box fan in there and try to cool the carcass down and dry the carcass out as fast as possible. So we got a pile of guts, we got a dressed out deer, we got a hide in one pile, a pile of guts, and a pile of meat and bone. All these things can be used in different ways. Every single part of that can be used. There's nothing that has to go to waste. Like I've seen a lot of hunters just take the meat and go. Like they leave the hide in the woods, they leave the guts in the woods, they leave the legs in the woods, like the feet, and even sometimes the head if it's not like a trophy animal or something like that. And for their ethics, that's fine because in their eyes, that's all going back to the land. Those guts will feed a lot of animals. Like you'd be amazed at how much activity happens at a gut pile. It's absolutely astounding. You put a trail camera on one of those, you'll see mice and chickadees all the way to ravens and wolves and bears coming over to eat from that pile for weeks, if not months even. So in that ethics, it's still – in the grand scheme of things, it's okay. In my personal ethics, that's not okay. I take everything back. I take everything I can back. I leave as little behind as possible. I even have some friends that when they go hunting in the winter and they get animals, they'll even scoop up the bloody snow after and make that into a stock. Like they use everything. And that's it more in line with what I prefer. That's what jives with me. But like I'm not going to tell a hunter who left their gut pile behind that they're a horrible human being because animals are going to live off this. Like life will come from this death regardless. Nothing goes to waste.
Helps fertilize the ground.
Totally, totally. So I'm not like one of those guys that's going to get on somebody's case. But for me, when it's my animal, I take everything.
Yeah.
everything I can. And so let's look at the organs. We already talked about some of the edibility. We have the kidney, we have the liver, we have all those beautiful meals that we know of already from hearing it growing, like steak and kidney pie and all that, liver and onions. We know those things are edible. The lungs are also edible. You can scramble those up almost like eggs and cook them up, and they're pretty good that way. Even the brain, as I said earlier, can be eaten. I personally prefer to use that for hide tanning or bait, because I'm not really big on eating brain, because that's where one of the leading causes of health issues can start for some animals with human consumption. But those other organs, like the intestines, can't really eat those per se, but we can still use them, like sausage casing.
Well, even as a good Irish boy going along that, you can make blood pudding.
Yeah, blood pudding, 100%. Hell yeah. Haggis from my Scottish heritage. Like haggis is just all those organs ground up and mixed in with some barley and some oats and a bunch of spices and cooked in the stomach.
I've got Scottish there too, but I can't trace it back. I need some 23andMe or something. I've got a Scottish last name and no known Scottish ancestor.
And that's where it gets confusing, right? Yeah. So, like, we can eat a lot of those organs, but then there's also, like, other practical applications of the organs. There's some really cool documentaries on the National Film Board of Canada's website where you can find, like, traditional Inuit hunters using animals and processing them and using them in unique ways. Like, they would actually take the seal skins, the membrane of the seal skin, and stitch up all the holes real tight and then inflate it. Sew that shut, and those could either be floaters for a harpoon or toys for their kids. Like basically like a balloon for their kid to bop around and play with. It's kind of really cool to watch. It's really cute. But and just practical. Like, hey, here's something to play with, kid. Enjoy it. But beyond that, like you have the intestines can be turned into lacing. Like we have the ability to turn into sausage casings, but you can also clean them out of any fecal matter or digestive fiber that's left inside the intestines, wash them out, and stretch it quite a bit. And that's like, we hear the phrase like cat gut on tennis rackets. Originally, it was actually pork intestine. And I believe even horse intestine was used for those rackets, for the traditional tennis rackets, badminton rackets, etc. Nowadays, they're made of synthetic polypropylene and such. But you can use it to make very strong lacing for a lot of stuff. I've made like 50 feet of rope, like twisted, reverse wrapped deer intestine. And it was some of the strongest rope I've ever made. Long lasting. It was working for bow drill strings. It was working for actual hunting bow strings. Really strong stuff. Beyond that, for the organs, you also have like, and the viscera, you have like the bladder and the stomach that were traditionally used for either cooking vessels or water carriers. The old-fashioned, like the goat skin canteens that a lot of people have seen, those goat skins were made of goat bladders. The Plains nations like the Hidatsa, the Lakota, the Blackfoot, and other nations would use the bladders of the bison cleaned out, and they would use those as water carriers, containers to scoop water from the river and bring them back into camp. You can make bags out of them. You can make waterproof bags out of them, which is really kind of cool. The traditional comic or boot or not necessarily like a muckluck, but like a footwear of the Inuit people specifically was a liner that was waterproof, made from the organ lining of seal. And so these parts can be used in ways that we as Westerners would have our minds blown. Like, there's so much unique things that can be done with the animals that we use around us. Like the divers, the deep sea divers of the South Pacific were taking sea turtle shells and scraping them so thin that they could become lenses for goggles. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
That's actually insane to me. The Inuit people would take the skin lining of caribou and stretch it out and flesh it to make sure there's no fat and grease on it. And they would stretch it out and dry those in rolls. And then on certain lodges they would build that were made out of sod, they could now have windows that would let sunlight in and keep the space warm. Like, these are incredible uses of an animal that we just never think about in a modern day. We just think about the hide, the bones, and the meat. Like, that's all we're thinking about. But there's so much more going on. That shit just gets me nerdy as hell. I just start rambling on. The eyes are edible of practically every mammal and bird I know of. But what's even more interesting for me is that some indigenous peoples from around the world would basically puree the eyes and mix them with pigments because it would help the paint bond to wood better. Like, it was a better binding agent than just simply water or milkweed sap or what have you. I'm trying to remember the proper term for it, but the fluid of an eye, the proteins in there bond to wood and other plant matter really well. So if you're trying to paint your bow or you're trying to paint a canoe paddle, they would mix that with the fluid of an eyeball instead of using water or animal fat or what have you to make a grease paint. They could use I'm trying to remember the word. It's not viscous. There's an actual term. It starts with a V in there. It's not viscera because that's all organs that are edible.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm getting at. It's the eye fluid. Beyond that, on organs, like the brain, of course, it can be food, but it can also be used for the tanning of hides. So when we look at smoke tanned or brain tanned hide, a lot of people are getting into that these days because it's 100% biodegradable, no chemical concerns. Also, smoke tanned hides are, frankly, in my opinion, some of the best kind of leathers to be working with for footwear in the wintertime because it's fully breathable and dries quickly and doesn't deform when it dries. Like when you take commercial tanned leather and you wash that thoroughly and then dry it, it ends up becoming very stiff. Whereas smoke tan moose hide on my moccasins, my snowshoe moccasins, they have never gotten stiff in the entire time that I've owned them, and I've used them like day in and day out throughout the winter seasons. It's incredible that way. To the point that I know of some people that have actually like take their smoke tan jacket and will throw it in a washing machine with modern detergents and wash it in there, get rid of all the grease and dirt and everything else that was on the hide, on the coat, and then just hang it up and dry it. And the next day they put it back on and there's not a single like creasy, raw, hidey, stiff part of the whole jacket. It fits perfectly the next day again. It's really kind of cool. And what's going on there is the brain is basically chopped up or pureed or made into a paste. And once you flesh the hide and you remove the epidermis, which is where the hair connects to the subdermal layers, and you've scraped that all off, and you've rinsed the hide clean, and it's this nice white flesh, and it's nice and rubbery almost, you are going to rub the brain matter on both sides thoroughly, and you can immerse it in hot water that's got the brain matter in it, or you can just rub it as a paste all over the hide and roll it up and let it set for a day or two. If you do the soak method, you can pretty much, as soon as you pull it out, you can start working it. The method that I use for that is I'll actually freeze the hide and then have a bucket with the brain pureed in hot, hot, hot water. Not like boiling water, but as hot as your tap will get it. And then I throw the frozen little ball of deer skin into that bucket. And when that's thawed, it's brained. It's ready to go. I can start stretching and breaking down the fibers and softening the hide up into buckskin. And then you smoke it afterwards to make sure that brain matter doesn't get washed out, but also to specifically make sure that the hide gets 100% tanned. The smoke is part of the tanning process. So the brain can do that for you. You can do that with other emulsified fats. If you take a soap and oil mix, you can mix those together like a Dawn bar, like not Dawn, an ivory bar of soap and shave it up and melt that down. You can mix that with like olive oil or coconut oil and make an equivalent to the brain. Other people that are going with different methods because it's cleaner, because again, working with brain is pretty stinky, it's pretty sticky, it's pretty kind of nasty, and if there is a potential disease, it's going to be in the brain.
Now, is that where like a vegetable tan means? It's like using...
That's a different thing. Vegetable tan is using bark or other tannin-rich plant fiber to break down the fibers of the hide and do almost a very similar thing. And that's where you get like your boot leather and your belts and your knife sheaths. That's vegetable tan leather. And that's a different kind of process. You can bark tan a hide, let's say a deer hide, in about 2 months of soaking it in the tannins. Some people can do it faster depending on what mixes they're doing and what batch their recipe is. In my experience, it takes usually about 2 months for a deer skin in like hemlock bark bath. And then when you pull that out, you can stretch it out, break it, and soften it. But you can also leave it almost. Just stretch it out and let it dry and kind of just rub it a little bit. Or you can break it down and get it really, really velvety soft. And you get different qualities of leather because of that.
Yeah.
You can have your stiff boot leather all the way to almost like buckskin or at least garment-grade leather. And that's where you're going to see like your tooling leather and everything come from. Modern-day veg tan leather, just like most other modern tan leathers, are chemically treated. It's using like chemical breakdown vegetable tenants. So it's a little bit more industrial, and it's a little bit not messier, but a little more efficient in the direction of, like, you wouldn't want to do this in your home because you may be dealing with some pretty dangerous chemicals, whereas you can bark tan in your basement. Like, it's not a big deal. If you have a basement or you have a back shed, you can be bark tanning in there. And it's just a big vat, preferably a wooden vat or a plastic bucket like a Rubbermaid, that you have the hide just soaking and floating in a good tannin-rich broth, kind of. And that's what veg tan leather is. Good question. Great question, actually, because I was going to talk about that eventually, but I was sure I was going to forget about it, too. So, yeah, your smoke tan and your veg tan leathers, they are different things, but they both can be done from a natural, like vegetable tan leather was one of Ontario's earliest, like, Eurasian, like, European settler industries. Once the trapping era was kind of done, we started going after the hemlock trees in Ontario. And that's why there's, like, stands of hemlock, but not like it used to be.
Yeah.
Hemlock was one of the prevailing conifer trees in Ontario. And what would happen is they would roll into one spot that had a lot of hemlock trees near a creek or a river or a lake, and they would chop them all down, strip all the bark off every single twig, every single trunk, everything they could, crush that all up, and start boiling that into a vat. And then they would take the wood and basically build a log cabin to be their tannery. And then that's where they would tan all the cow hides, steer hides, et cetera, for the industries that they were selling it to. And then when they started running out of hemlocks, they would start shipping in the hemlock bark to those spots. And then eventually those got turned into the more efficient chemical tanneries that we then see along places like Port Hope, Coburg area, down the Canadian Ontario, southwestern Ontario region. You see the shipping of those things. And in some areas, they even shipped the hemlock bark from other areas to them. Whereas in some places, they just built the cabin. When they ran out of hemlock trees, they shut the whole thing down and moved on to the next spot and just did it again and again, kind of like locusts. Not sure which one was more environmentally friendly. I don't know if any of them was more sustainable or more carbon neutral than the next, or environmentally sustainable. But
when you bring mass production in, then anything starts exploiting the resources.
Exactly. And so we got to kind of think about that. Like, you and I could easily bark tan enough leather to keep you and I happy for years.
Yeah.
Would we want to do that as a job? We would run it at, like, we have two or three hemlock trees down at the camp right now, as you and I got to find out today from that windstorm. So there's enough bark there for us to tan a lot of hides and make a lot of hemlock bark stain and all that cool stuff. But there's definitely not enough for us to make an industry. We would have to cut a lot of trees down to get that to happen.
Stain more of my spoons, he fixes.
Right? Yep. So with the hide and everything else in the brain, like, the organs can be used in so many different directions than just, again, eating and cooking. When we look at an animal, it's more than just food. There's so much that they can give us. And that's one of the, like, we going even back to that ethics of hunting that you and I had a few months back, this is part of that for me. Like, I have to make as much use as I can to the best of my ability. Does that mean I make use of every single organ? Not really. Like, there's plenty of organ in there that I just don't use. I have no need for bladder bags. If I had a bladder bag from every deer I killed, I would have bladder bags hung along all these rafters and have no room for my other stuff. Like, and even not just from the deer I killed, but the deer I've processed, like all the roadkill deer that I've received over the years, I would have a lot of bladders to deal with as bags. And there's a lot of organs that I just have no need for, or I just don't have a use for that time, or just don't have the room for it. Like, I have to pack, especially if you're doing, like, backcountry hunting, you got to pack all of that out. It's a lot of gushy, ushy, mushy, wet fluids that are going to be in your backpack that you're hiking out of there with. And so, again, we can go back to that ethical question of, like, what is ethically okay to leave behind? I look at it in a different direction. I'm a trapper. I can use all of those organs that I don't want to eat to bring in animals to my trap line at bait stations, or stuffing it into my trap boxes and my sets, which is something I'm currently thinking about, because I'm literally on tomorrow afternoon cleaning and prepping my traps, because trapping season is in full swing now. And now that I'm not thinking so much about deer, I really got to get my traps cleaned because they haven't even been looked at since last season. So I have that bait now. I have all that bait that I may not have wanted to eat, but I know that everything else wants to eat it.
And now that would be fine because it's not like habit forming or anything. You're not right. continuously feeding them and making exactly. them come back to that certain spot.
Yeah. Well, so what a bait station is on a trap line, there's different questions about like how bait station works. In the trapping world, there's a lot of studies done on this. We're like, let's say there's a 100-acre forest right here and there's a 100-acre forest right beside it, and both of them have the same population of animals, right?
Yeah.
The mortality rate of both forests, one of them is trapped, one of them is not trapped. The mortality rate throughout the entire trapping season is identical regardless, because the animals in the untrapped area are going to starve to death. That's just, it's just the fact that when winter comes, it's harder on everybody. So as a trapper, I'm lessening the pressure on the other surviving animals by removing some animals from the equation. There's not as likely of a chance of everybody starving. But to add to my ethics, I will put in bait stations. So if I have a, let's say, 20-kilometer long trap line, every kilometer, I'm going to drop just a pile of guts. Just a pile of guts or some carcass parts that I can't use that will then feed animals in my area and bring them towards my trap line. And that may not bring them into my traps, but that's going to put them in the region where I'm trapping, so it's going to be more likely that I can trap some of these animals. So for me, there's a twofold there. First off, I want to get more animals on my trap line so I can catch them. Secondly, especially because my trap line's tiny. My trap line is less than 500 meters long. My trap line is so small that if I was to get any fur at all, I have to use bait stations to attract animals. But the second part is now the animals that do survive in my forest don't starve. So they're going to be healthy, happy animals. And I'm not habit forming them because they're not coming in. It's not all year round.
You're not coming every weekend.
Exactly. Exactly. It's I'm dumping it when I have the animal. So what some people do is they'll go from like late October into early November and basically drive the roads looking for road kills. And they'll just scoop up all those animals that are going to attract animals to the road anyways and get rid of them from there. Remove that attract into the road where you're going to get a lot of more coyotes getting hit, raccoons getting hit, turkey vultures getting hit, crows getting hit. Now all those scavengers aren't going to the roads. They're going to the bait station where the birds aren't going to get hit by anything. All the scavengers that are coming in are going to have a meal. But also we're getting them away from the road and we're attracting more activity onto the trap line. And the more activity there is on the trap line, like I've heard some people say, like, don't you worry about having deer on the trap line and all this stuff. It's going to attract, like, the coyotes are going to go after the deer instead. No, the coyotes are looking for a meal. So if they see that there's deer activity happening in my woods, they're going to come check out my woods. And then if they're checking out the deer, they're going to smell some bloody stuff over here and go take a look. Oh, there's a bait pile. They're going to eat some bait.
Yeah.
At the bait station. And then they're going to keep, when that bait station finally gets empty, the animals that are left are going, where can I swear I can smell some more blood. And oh, look, there's a trap right over there, but they can't see the trap. They can smell the bait in there though, and they go for it. So there's multiple reasons to make bait stations, and all of them are, in my eyes, ethically neutral. Like they're not a good thing or a bad thing. It's helping the environment, but it's helping the animals in the environment, but not necessarily habit forming them or, necessarily getting them to go to my traps. Like a lot of people are like, you're doing that just to attract them into your traps. No, the bait that's in the bait in the trap set is what's supposed to attract them to my trap. The bait station is a feeding point. Like it's a place that they can come in and just eat a bunch of roadkill. And that's kind of how I look at it. Same with the guts or the other parts of the animal I can't use. Often if there's a bunch of bones that I just have no need for, like I've gotten all the meat I can off it and I just can't get these little morsels off, you'd have to sit there with like a little fine knife trying to trim off every little piece. I'll hang those in the woods. And now all the winter birds have something to chew on. Same with fat. Venison fat, deer fat, from the cervids, from the deer family, deer, moose, elk, caribou, it's very waxy. It tastes fine, but the texture is really uncomfortable to the mouth. Like a lot of people just don't enjoy the feel of it. The fat itself, though, has a lot of uses. Like you can use it to make into grease paints, and you can make grease finishes for your woodware and such with deer tallow and everything else. But you can also use it as a fuel for lights, for making oil lamps and such, like the old-fashioned kudliks of the Inuit people. All those kinds of tools you can make, or even torch fuel, all that stuff. But I can also just take those big chunks of fat and hang them in the trees and feed the birds for the winter. And I'm fine with that. Personally, I'm okay with that because I'm not going to have much use of the fat. I've got bucket after bucket of linseed oil over there. I have tongue oil and I have electric lights. Like, I don't really need to use the deer fat in that direction. I know plenty of people that do.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. If I hear someone that says that I'm looking for deer tallow, I'm looking for deer fat because they want to make soap or what have you that they want to use that fat for, I'll send them mine because I don't leave it in the woods. I take everything home with me. And I'll check and see what people are looking for, and then I'll send it off to them if they need it. But if I don't hear anything by December 31st, I'm going to start hanging it in the trees to make sure the birds get fed. Because I'm a bird nerd. I love seeing the nuthatches and the chickadees and all the other winter birds that come into the camp. So I'll hang the fat up in the air around for them. And same thing with the bones. I'll hang the bones. There's bones on my roof right now as we're sitting here because I like the birds coming in the winter and picking the bones clean. It's just a pleasant activity for me to see that I'm helping the birds a little bit. Especially because we give them such a hard time the rest of the year. Animals have a hard time dealing with people year round. So if we can give them a little bit of a boost when it's the hardest time of year, I figure I'm doing a little bit of karma balancing going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So once you have like all the meat taken off and turned that into food and you got all the hide set aside, you can salt it or freeze it until you're ready to tan it. And then you're going to turn to veg tan leather or bark tan leather or brain tan or smoke tan leather, whatever you want to make it into, or rawhide. You can make into rawhide and make all the lacing you need for your snowshoes or what have you just by fleshing it and taking all the hair off and just let it dry as it is. And
that's making thread.
Yeah.
For making your moccasins or muckluckers.
Totally. And so from there, we then have like a few other cuts on the animal that people might not know what to do with. You can cook the genitals. Some refer to it as the creamiest cut. I personally I've had plenty of prairie oysters in my time. When I was living out in Wyoming, everybody was trying to invite us to the Beulah, Wyoming Testicle Festival. Shout out to Beulah, Wyoming for all 33 of you that live there. It's an interesting experience. It's not a bad meal, but it's not necessarily something that I'm like chomping at the bit to get to, you know? Yeah. Like, it's not really my favorite thing out there. A lot of people love it. Not for me. It's not 100% for me. I'll eat it if I have to, but it's not really my choice. Other parts that other people don't usually think about is like the nose. Like on a moose, there's this giant, like, cartilageous nose sticking off of the bone, off the skull. And it's actually like a delicacy in northern communities, a lot of northern communities. And a lot of northern community people, whether they're Cree, like Nahiwak, Meshkegowak, Innu, or the Dene people as well, they'll just char the hair off, like scorch the hair right off and just slow cook that in a pot and make it into like almost like a pot roast. I prefer to parboil it and just scrape the hair out myself because I really don't like the burnt hair kind of aftertaste that's in there.
Yeah.
But you can then just cook that down and it's just cartilage and fat in there. And that concept of like cartilage and tendons and everything else kind of lead us to the other thing you can do with a lot of these bones and tendons and all this stuff coming off the animal. You can make broths. You can make really rich soups and meals out of this stuff. Like you can make it into braising liquid and braise down a moose brisket or a venison shank roast or blade in roast. You can use that bone broth and tendon broth that you made earlier in the season that you just bottled up or jarred up and then froze. And you're ready to rock with that stuff. It's absolutely phenomenal. Like, once I started learning about how to make a good broth out of these things, it changed the world. Tendon or sinew is its own thing altogether. You can use sinew for making bow strings. You can make sinew for making bow backing for very powerful bows. It can actually increase to some degrees, depending on how well you do it. You can increase the draw power of your homemade bow by up to 15 pounds by backing it properly with sinew from the deer and the elk and the moose and other animals that you've hunted. But you can also just render it down in a pot, in a slow cooker or in a big cast iron Dutch oven with some water and some onions and celery and carrots and just slowly cook it down until it just falls apart and add a little bit of acidity near the end, like lemon juice is what I usually use, or red wine vinegar or white wine vinegar, and or just white wine itself. And just cook that down into this beautiful stock that is going to be amazing. And you can even then slow cook that down until you've evaporated most of the water out of it. You can basically make your own OXO cubes or bouillon, which is just, you can become your own Gordon Ramsay, people. Like, you can get really, really into this stuff and have a real fun time not wasting the animal. and you get some. You can go all the way to making, like I jokingly said a moment ago before we went on back on the air, you can make a moose nose pho if you really tried your hardest at it. You could easily make that happen, very easily. So there's all these parts that we don't think about, but are part of that animal. The tendon, like a lot of people refer to the backstrap tendon as the silver skin. The backstrap is the longest sinew in the entire animal. So if you go from the tip of the tail to the base of the skull, you got the whole length of one continuous fiber. That's a strong cord too. Sinew is the strongest natural fiber known to humankind, is the sinew of an animal, because it has continuous fiber. And it's a very elastic, it's very tensile strength, tensile strong. And so it can stretch and take a lot of stretch abuse and come back almost elastically to what it was before. So whether it's the leg tendons or the back tendons, you can use those to make a lot of things. Or if you're not really into doing stuff fully into like the ancestral skills category of making things, you can just cook it all down. Take all those tendons. Like the best part of a shank roast is when you braise it down for a long time, all the tendon becomes this gooey, succulent, falling apart gelatin that when it mixes in with the broth makes it just that much better tasting. Like, we already had dinner. I'm getting hungry again. Just talking about this. And we still have to do the wild game recipe episode after this. Oh my God. We're going to be hungry tonight. I know we are. One other thing on the gelatinous and like sinew and all those like very strong proteins we're talking about was something to do with the hide. I completely forgot to mention was you have the raw hide, and why raw hide becomes stiff and strong is those same gelatins and sinew-like consistency compounds that are in the tendons and everything else we're talking about. You can actually extract that and make it into glue. So you take a deer hide, and from what I've been told before, I haven't done it to the extent of making a large volume of it, but if you take 12 deer skins, according to the people I've listened to talk about it, you take 12 deer skins and you basically just shred them up and boil them and simmer them and simmer them and simmer them and skim the scum off the top of the water, you can make about half a gallon of glue. Like, that's like when we talk about like the whole like using the whole horse thing that they talk about in the past, like we're gonna turn that horse into glue. That's what they're talking about, is the hide and the hoofs and all those hooves, all that's getting boiled down. You can do the same thing with the toe hooves on a deer or a moose. Add that in with the hides and just boil the snot out of it. Skim all that scum off. Let it cool. Wipe off the water. One technique I've done before when I was doing it with just a couple of hides is you then pour all the water that you've skimmed off, all that liquid, into a steel bowl and put that in the freezer. And then when it freezes, the fat-rich layer will be in one piece and the other part is water. Frozen water, ice for those scientists out there. And we just cut that ice off, and the rest of that's hide glue that you can then boil again or heat up again and then filter it. Or you can filter it as you're straining it or skimming it, get all the gunky pieces out, and then you're with this hide glue that you just basically put into a soapstone dish on top of a heater, or you can use a metal container. I recommend the soapstone dishes that are for hide glue. They're not going to burn the hide glue. They're not going to overheat it too quickly because it takes a wild heat of that stone. There's also ceramic dishes, like these little mini, you'll see them out there. Yeah, like ramekins. These little ceramic little heating plates that are used as well that you can put the hide glue bits in. And that's what's going to be used to either back your bow. If you're gluing, like a lot of hide glue is used to bind hides together when you're doing sewing for leather work. You can paint a little bit of that kind of hot hide glue on, stick it together, clamp it, and then stitch that together. It'll have a stronger bond. Hide glue is one of the strongest glues we have from nature. So instead of going into the heavy epoxies and all that kind of stuff, we can use hide glue to do a lot of this stuff. It's kind of rubbery. It can have a little bit of give and take and abuse. And so I've even seen people use it to attach arrowheads to arrow shafts because it can take a lot of trauma when it hits something. And not shattered. Very strong. Just like a tendons all over again. You're just boiling all that stuff down into a liquid form in a sense. So you're basically making an animal epoxy, an animal-based epoxy instead of a plant-based epoxy. Instead of using your spruce gum glue, you can use the hide glue instead.
Oh, I'll have to start making my own gelatin so I can make my homemade gummies even more homemade.
Exactly. You can use gelatin in other ways as well, beyond just making hydrogen. You can make it into edibles. You can make it into gummies and candies, and you can use it for different kinds of cooking as well. I'm looking at the time on this podcast, and we've not even touched on, like, we're like, oh, this is going to be a fast episode. Let's just get right into the recipes soon after. This is, like, our warm-up episode. And I was like, man, like, we're already at an hour, and we haven't even touched on, like, the bone and antler use. Those ones have a lot of categories in there, but, like, this is a long episode already.
Like I was saying just, though, to you before we start back up was that if you want to use the whole animal, you got to tell people how to use the whole animal.
That is true.
Like, yo, figure it out, bud. Just take care of it.
You got this.
It's done.
I guess we got to use the whole podcast.
Just throw the whole deer into a pot. Just boil it down into a stew, and you're good to go.
And there's some unique ones out there, like amongst the Diné or the Navajo down south in the American Southwest. I've seen them eat, like, when they're gutting the sheep that they raise. Like, sheep herding has been part of the Navajo culture for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. And in there, you have, like, when they're gutting the sheep, they're popping out sheep turds and popping them in their mouth and eating. It's like second harvest, fresh from the animal. Okay. And it's like, at first you're like, that is disgusting. And you realize, well, it's just plant proteins and plant fiber and then a little bit of salt from what they've been licking.
Maybe we won't be using the whole animal.
That's what I'm getting at. Like, there's certain parts, like, I just can't wrap my head around, and I, like, was raised around using a lot of the animal, if not all of it.
I feel like the risks outweigh the benefits on that part.
Fair enough. I'm not drinking the moose urine, I can tell you that. So the last two kind of parts of this that we got to talk about is, like, bone and antler. And I say that as if that's going to be, like, the short part. This is the actual long part I was preparing for this whole episode. Starting with just the bones. First off, the edibility portion. Stock and broth, as we talked about already, it's what gets Baby Yoda, a.k.a. Well, should we do a spoiler here?
No. Oh, wait. When is this going to be released?
This is released already. Like, we're releasing this the day after.
Talk about Grogu?
Yeah. It's what makes him strong, man. That bone broth, man. So bone broth, but also the marrow itself, or marrow, if you talk to certain people. There's, like, certain ways. Like, there's a restaurant here in town in Peterborough. I want to give a shout out to Tyler. Rare is a steakhouse in Peterborough. Phenomenal restaurant. Great cook. Exquisite food. And one of the appetizers they have, but also one of the condiments they can have for your steak is marrow. And so what they'll do is they'll roast the whole marrow leg bones, which are your cannon bones and your femur bones of the deer, or in their case, beef. They're roasting that at around 400 to 500 degrees. And then they take it to a bandsaw and cut it in half. And you can either scoop it out with some salt on it and eat that on some toast, or they can apply it onto your steak. And that's a very common thing around the world, is marrow is a very, very fat rich food that has even been, like, connected to the potential evolution of our brains way back in Africa before we were modern human. When we were Homo habilis, there was the potentiality that we were throwing rocks to chase lions and other predators off their kills. And when we finally got to the kill, those animals stripped all the meat and organs off it. So what's left was the bone. And so we would take these rocks that we threw that had sharp edges on them and crack the bones open to eat the marrow. And that high fat, high protein diet of marrow helped increase our brain growth and our brain functions. So marrow can be very nutritious. It's also an easy way to get the fat proteins, but also calcium, because it's part of the bone development, is the marrow itself also has calcium. There's a lot of people around the world that didn't have dairy in their diet, but they had a perfectly fine content of calcium in their digestion, in their diet, because of eating marrow. Mm-hmm. So that alone, just talking about the edibility of bone, is the stock and the marrow that's in there. Beyond that, there's a lot of other uses. I actually had to make a list for this one. And this is a very short and condensed Reader's Digest list. There's a whole lot of other uses for bone. Knife blades. Brown bone and green bone are two different things. Brown bone is bone that has been aged for a while, has been off the carcass for a while. Green bone is fresh killed deer or a fresh killed animal. And down in South America, you'll actually witness certain peoples, certain indigenous tribes, where they kill a small deer. They actually have white-tailed deer in like Colombia and Brazil. Like when you realize how when I was doing the white-tailed deer episode, I had to do some research on like their range, and it's insane how far south into South America they go, and that's their native range. So they'll kill the deer and they'll take a machete and they'll smash one of the small cannon bones on the front leg. Just smash it with the spine of their machete until it breaks.
Not Bambino.
And they take that bone and basically bend it until it pops and they cause a compression fracture or a compound fracture to come out of the hide. And that green bone is sharp enough to skin the rest of the animal so they can keep their machete sharp. So green bone has its own uses. Like that fresh bone off the animal has its own uses right there. It's very sharp stuff. Beyond that, we can use brown bone or dry bone to make really good fleshing knives. We use them for skinning beaver and skinning other fur-bearing mammals, because when you're skinning the animal, you don't really want to use a knife incision because you're just going to cut the hide up or cut the meat up. It's basically you more like want to put almost like a bark spud in there to separate the skin from meat, right? A bone knife, especially like a moose rib bone or a bison rib bone or a cow rib bone that has been ground and sharpened, as sharp as you can get it, won't easily pierce the hide and won't easily damage the flesh. And so it's the perfect tool to kind of like scrape off that hide and help you peel that hide off. So already right there, the knife blades alone can be very useful from that. So much so that we've even used rib bones in the past when we were building a birch bark canoe. We made a moose rib bone mokotagan, a crooked knife, where the blade was a moose's rib bone. And it was sharp enough to shave. It was dry rib bone from the year before, was able to shave cedar and shave it pretty well. And we ended up giving that to one of our staff members, Christina Yu, who's slowly creating a mokotagan collection of like different styles of mokotagan for her own learning. So she got to play with that. She has that in her collection now, which is pretty cool. I have a bunch of other moose rib bones laying around. I got to get around to actually making more of those again.
I remember we were at Bulk Barn last year and you're looking at the bones.
Like, that they had we can use these. We can use these rib bones that they just have in the dog food aisle.
Yeah.
You can use that stuff for making tools. And Ryan's probably sitting there going like, what the hell have I signed up for to work with this guy? But yeah, so other things you can do. The rib bones from moose make really good projectile points for arrowheads. You can use the cannon and femur bones to make very large spearheads, atlatl projectile points, harpoon blades for salmon and char and other large fish. And with that direction of like barbed things, you can make barbs and fish hooks, like these gorge fish hooks. My friend Jim Knapp, quite a few years ago now, I think it was 2016 or 2015, went out and made his own entire tackle set and caught trout using bone fish hooks. And I think it was dogbane twine for the thread for the fishing line. Phenomenal project that he worked on.
You see how many lost hooks are trapped on tree branches and under logs and stuff. It makes sense to kind of use something that's a little more earth friendly,
biodegradable or something.
Yeah,
totally. Barbs for fishing spears can be made out of bone. One of the more unique ones that people always get kind of start giggling when I start talking about it is the baculum. So a baculum is a bone found in the penis of some mammals, not all mammals. Cervids and hominids do not have them. So no, there is no bone there, guys. Sorry. I'm not sure why you keep saying bone there, but there is no bone there. But bear baculum, the penis bone of the black bear, has been used for hundreds if not thousands of generations as an awl for making birch bark baskets, bark baskets of hickory bark, elm bark, basswood bark, but also canoes, birch bark canoes going through cedar wood, because the baculum cross section on a bear's baculum is triangular, and there's no marrow in a baculum, very little marrow at least, and so you can grind it down on a stone to a very easy to work with triangular cross section point that's fairly strong. I've worked with a few of them now. I'm not going to say that I want to make, like, one day I would love to make an entire birch bark canoe with just like tools that we would have used before steel got here. That'd be a really cool project to work on with like moose rib bone and beaver tooth mokotagans and awls from baculums, and copper awls as well were used. it would just be a kind of cool project. On the subject of awls, you also have the ulna bone, which is a certain bone on deer leg bones that attach to the tendons, and they come out to a point. I actually had one hanging up. It's not hanging up now, or else I'd show as a prop to Ryan.
They also have radius?
Yes, yeah. I believe they do. It's a different bone altogether that I'm not – I think that's part of the canon.
They got the radius and the ulna.
Yeah, they have both of them, yeah. So the deer ulna is got this kind of cool knob on one end, and then it tapers off on one point of this long spike that you can sharpen into a good awl for doing leather work, for doing baskets. If you're doing like fiber baskets and such, you wouldn't necessarily want to use it on birch bark baskets and such, but if you're doing like weaving projects, you can use that ulna. We've even made from a moose ulna, we cut off the knob end and kept the rest and actually made it into a needle for basically sewing or weaving a thatched roof. And on that line, rib bones from bears have been used by the Anishinaabeg people, by Menominee, by the Miami people, by everybody from the Great Lakes region, at least, that I'm aware of. They make rib bone needles that are double-ended, so they have a point on each end of the rib bone. They're very thin because it's rib bone, and they were used to sew cattail mats for making the winter lodges. So it's a really cool, and some of them were like exquisitely decorated, like with beautiful little scalloping along one edge and all these cute, cool little curlicues and all that stuff all over them. Really pretty stuff. From rib bones. Again, rib bones can be used for making knife blades, arrowheads, and awls. Needles, not awls. Fish hooks, we already mentioned. Handles for knives and other tools. So we can make, I've got a friend, John Godozzi. Shout out to John, longtime friend of mine. One of his favorite knives, he made himself. The blade he set into a, I think it was a wolf leg bone from the first wolf he ever trapped. And he turned that leg bone into a beautiful handle. And it looks real awkward looking. Like I wouldn't, when you first look at it, you're like, that doesn't look comfortable. But when you grasp it, it fits. Like it perfectly registers in your fingers and your thumb really well. So those same thing with like deer leg bones. You often see like deer leg bone knives. Yeah. I've even seen one person who made a turkey foot into a knife handle. And they had the turkey foot with the spur of the turkey that would rest between your ring finger and your baby finger, little finger, almost like the sub hilts on the front of some fighting knives, but at the back. It was kind of a cool like register, and you have this pommel of just a gnarly looking turkey's foot and those claws just barely grazing the back of your hand.
So you see a lot of knife scales made out of bone and antler. Yep.
Definitely. And then a few others, hide scrapers. The leg bones, the cannon bone from a deer or a caribou or an elk or a moose can be turned into really good double hand hide scrapers that look kind of like a draw knife. Mm-hmm. You can also turn them by cutting them at a chisel angle. You can turn them into one hand scrapers that are used for basically punch scraping moose hides that are being hung up over a post or hung from a beam. You can basically punch scrape along with that chisel like edge scraping away. Oddly enough, bone does not freeze the way other things freeze. So when we're talking about winter camping on one of our last episodes, actually it was our very last episode, we talked about ice chisels. The moose femur, which is one of the densest bones in North America, shy of the elk femur, does not bond to water and freeze up. Now, I've used ice chisels in the past, and if you're like dealing with true sub-zero temperatures and chopping away, sometimes ice starts to build up on that steel and kind of almost like gums it up and doesn't let it chop very well. It won't do that with a femur chisel blade. So traditionally, that's how we were cutting holes in the ice, was using a femur from a moose as the blade of a long-handled chisel. Beyond that, for other types of hide scrapers, but then we have scapula, shoulder blade of the moose, shoulder blade of the deer, shoulder blade of the bison, all that stuff. They're used in different ways. They're sometimes turned into scrapers themselves for hide fleshing. But also the larger animals like a moose or an elk or a bison, you can make scapula hoes for your garden, for digging holes, for working the ground. And where scapula for a deer really shines is when we're making those cattail mats. I'll take the deer scapula, the shoulder blade, and basically put it on top of a sharp rock and hit it with a mallet and chop off the socket that's attached, mm-hmm. that attaches to the rest of the leg. Chop that and get rid of that. And then I'll set the thinnest part of the shoulder blade on top of that sharp rock and hit it with the mallet again, snap all that stuff off. And you're left with this real like ragged edge. and you just take that and grind it against a piece of granite and smooth it out, and then take it to that sharp rock again and lay it perpendicular and start kind of cutting teeth slowly, grinding teeth into it, and you make yourself a little saw. And that saw will not cut you. It will not cut a child. It will not cut your pants. It will not cut anything except for plant fibers that are succulent in water, like cattail. Mm-hmm. And so traditionally, when we're building those cattail mats, it could be upwards of 1,000 cattail leaves on a single mat. That's a lot of cattail that needs to get cut. And so if you think about in a swamp, in a cattail marsh, stooped over cutting hundreds, if not thousands of cattails to get all those leaves, because you're going to need 3 to 5 layers of cattail per rung of your lodge to cover that thing completely, for to keep you warm and insulated at night in a traditional wigwam. That's a lot of stooping over and cutting. Or you give it to the kids. And the kids go through at a lower height, and they cut all the cattail down for you, and you go along and scoop it up and carry it out, because it's going to be heavy altogether. And you're the one carrying out all the bushels of cattail leaf, while the kids just go along with these saws that cannot cut a child and just saw away and knock down every cattail they see. And they can have some fun with that. I've done that with my cousins before when they're younger. Like, hey, try this stuff out for me. And they went out and they cut it. I went up behind them and they were having a grand old time. They didn't necessarily go in like a straight line either. They were like just kind of meandering through the swamp, cutting whatever they see in front of them. And sometimes they get bored and start sawing away at pieces of wood. And guess what? It won't do that. It'll just chip the teeth away. So don't let the kids do that part. But a cattail saw can be made from the scapula of a deer. And it can be made from other shoulder blades of large animals as well. But the shoulder blade of a deer is the one that I grew up understanding and knowing. And I swear I have them in the collection down here somewhere, but I got to go through all these boxes. And Ryan can vouch for me. There's a lot of junk down here that I just got to go through.
Well, I live down here, so.
You do. You do.
I snoop around a little bit.
You haven't found all the dirty magazines yet, have you?
Maybe.
Not all of them?
Not all of them.
I stashed them all over the place, so hopefully you didn't find all of them. I'm worried about you burning them for heat because it's so damn cold down here.
The pages are stuck together. It's not my fault.
On that note, let's talk about something other than the bones. Let's get into antler. So antler is different than a horn. Horns are permanently attached to the animal, and they grow throughout their life. Antlers fall off every winter, usually around February. And that's what the main difference is. The other obvious difference is like what they're made of. Antler is its own form of bone. It's basically the same like construct of bone, whereas a horn is actually closely related to hair. Or your fingernails.
Yeah.
So they are different. We're not going to talk too much about horn here because there's only a few horn-bearing mammals that we could potentially ever hunt in North America. The pronghorn, the bison, and the mountain goats and sheep, the bighorn sheep and such. They're not very common here in Ontario, any of those animals, so we're not really going to dive in. We're kind of sticking to the whole white-tailed deer category anyways. So we're going to talk about antler. Antler has a ton of different uses, and pretty much everything I described for bone, you can use antler. And more so. So first off, antler handles are some of the most beautiful pieces of art I've ever seen on really nice knives. And even not so great knives that you made yourself. You could put an antler handle on there and they just look really good. You can go all the way to making a stacked birch bark handle like the Sami people or Swami people do. And they'll use pieces of reindeer antler in there to kind of add strength to it, but also to add some character to it and make it unique. You can even do scrimshaw work on antler like they do with horn and bone and make it look even prettier. Antler first and foremost. The main thing I use antler for, though, in my toolbox is a burnisher for burnishing wood to make that wood nice and smooth and polished looking and just fancy looking. Burnishing with a good smooth part of the tine of a white-tailed deer or a good large chunk from a piece of moose antler that's been polished down and worn down. Not the big, like... rough or coarse or not trying to add more fuel to the fire, knobby parts of the antler. You don't really want to use those for that. You want to use the smooth, silky parts of the antler and use those as your burnishers to help polish and basically force the grain of the wood to be tighter and denser along the surface so it looks smooth and silky and shiny and satiny and other S words. A unique one that most people aren't aware of is that moose antler, the palm part of the antler, that isn't a tine. The tines are the spikes on antler. Everything else is either the crown, the stem, or the palm in the case of a moose. And even on caribou, they also have a palm on the front of their antler. That palm can actually be sliced down and shaved down into very thin pieces of product. Some people are making earrings and jewelry out of the tines as cross sections, or the whole palm, cutting that and carving that and detailing it. The Anishinaabeg and other Great Lakes woodland indigenous folk, we made hair combs out of it. So you would basically cut, let's say, a trapezoidal shaped piece, and the widest part is going to be the base of your handle, and the rest would be carved down into the teeth of your comb. And they would add a wooden clamp. It's kind of like the end of it to tell you, like, that's the stop. When you get down to that piece of wood, stop cutting. And they would scrape the bone thin, get rid of all the kind of marrow that's on the inside, remove all that until they have like almost an ivory white, clean inside layer of antler outside of the dark, worn, beaten up outside. Shave that all off too. And then when they add that clamp, they're going to take a flake of chert, or nowadays a hacksaw blade, and start scoring in and scoring and scoring it all the way down the length and start cutting each tooth individually. And then the base part, the handle part, would then be carved and decorated. One more common one is my buddy Nick Dillingham made one where he had an otter holding a ball, which was supposed to be the sun or the moon, I think in the story, holding the moon. And when he cut that disc, he then inlaid a piece of abalone shell to represent the moon. Like, absolutely beautiful. That's not a craft. That's not bushcraft. That is art. Yeah. Like, that is truly art. And there's so many different ways that antler has been used all over the world, everywhere from Japan and Korea to the Arctic. All wherever there's antler-bearing animals, people have been using antler to make art, true art, whether it's jewelry or it in itself functional art, like a haircut. Beyond that, there's a lot of other uses for antler. Let's go down the list again. Fishing spear prongs, the caribou antler is really well known for the classic, like, Inuit Leicester-style spears. And those prongs that come in almost like two big number sevens holding the fish in are actually flexible and able to take the stress of going around capturing the fish. And then you can pull them apart to set the fish off and release the fish from the spear. You can't do that with bone. And there's very few woods that will hold up in extreme cold and do that. But antler can do that. It has some flexibility to it. It has some give to it. Toggles for building up pressure, tension. So if we're trying to do like a really strong constrictor knot around like a spear shaft to hold a spearhead on, we would make two loops, one on each end of the cord that we're lashing with, and then put antler toggles in there and yank on those as hard as we could. And you can do that with wood, but that was better done with antler because it could hold the pressure. But more importantly, amongst the Inuit people, there's the form of bow that they make that doesn't have any wood in it. They have a caribou bone and sinew bow, traditionally done in the high Arctic towards the copper, what's historically referred to as the copper Eskimo, but the people of the copper region, the Inuit people of the copper region of the Arctic. They would take cannon bones of caribou, cut them basically into boards, drill holes at each end, and attach all these holes together until you had a long strip of these held together by sinew, or rawhide, that would then be allowed to dry and shrink, and everything would become one stiff piece. Then you would go at one end, and you would have a cable that's about almost as thick as your little finger, made out of a 3-ply of sinew, of the tendons from the caribou. And they would, basically the entire time that the men were shaving down all these bones and drilling these holes and tying it all together, a single Inuk woman was twisting this rope, this heavy cable that could be like 30 feet, 40 feet long, and they would then take the cable at one end, tie it off, and then every inch and a half, I believe, they would make a half hitch around the stick that they made, the bow, all the way down, and they'd come all the way back and all the way down, half hitching all the way down. And between the half hitches, they would then twist the sinew, and they would use an antler or ivory toggle to twist and twist and twist and twist and twist, and this is building up tension on the sinew, on the cable. And then when it's tied up as tight as it can, going all the way down, you'd tie it off with a clove hitch or another knot to keep that tension there. And then go to between the next two half hitches, twist, 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 tie it off, go down between the next two half hitches, twist, twist, twist. And this is building up a lot of tension, and you start bending the bow towards the sinew side. Well, that's the back of the bow. This is a cable-backed bow. And so what then is done is they would then bend the bow the other way and hang the, or string it. and all that tension is built up in the sinew, and all the compression resistance is in the bone. And by nature, you now have a bow that was capable of killing caribou and potentially even muskox with no wood involved whatsoever. That's freaking cool. Like bone and sinew and then antler or ivory used to finish it off and make the whole thing complete.
Well, I guess if you can make a kayak out of bone.
Driftwood and bone, yeah. So other options, gorge fish hooks. Just like the previous with bone, you can use the fish hooks out of antler. But another one that I experimented with last year, didn't have a huge amount of success with it, but that's because it was a piece of small moose antler, is an axe. You and I took it out to the Global Bushcraft Symposium with us.
Yeah.
I made myself an antler axe blade. And traditionally, they're made in Scandinavia and Siberia out of what the Europeans and the Eurasians refer to as elk. Elk is the Eurasian moose. So I took Canadian moose antler, and what you basically do is you cut the stem, which is the piece between the crown, which is what attaches to the skull, and the palm, which is, again, that big, wide piece that attaches to the tines. And that stem would then be cut on an angle, like a chisel blade, and then you would drill a hole through it perpendicular to that edge, or sorry, parallel with that edge. And that is where you would set your hand, or you put in perpendicular and make an axe. And you would set the handle through that. You would either make it almost like a tomahawk or socket fit, like a pickaxe, or you would actually drive it in like a normal axe handle and wedge it. And they're not, you know, the most amazing axe, but they will chop wood. Mm-hmm. They will chop down trees for sure. It's no less effective than a stone axe or a copper axe even. They work pretty much up to copper axe. It's pretty much similar attributes for chopping into the wood fiber. I would still prefer a copper axe or an antler axe because they're a lot easier to keep sharp because eventually you wear out of antler. But yeah, that's a lot of the uses of antler. There's a lot of other uses. And again, you can boil it if you really want to. There's also like the use of velvet from the antler where you're seeing getting into like this mystical properties of like using elk velvet from the antlers to help with everything from like miracle cures for cancer all the way to, you know, male supplements that are supposed to help you be very strong and very
fertile.
What's the word? Virile. Yeah. Virile is the word I like to use. I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff in detail because I believe it's a lot of it's just pseudoscience and bunk. But sure, if we want to look at it, like, yes, there are hormones in the elk when they're producing those antlers, and that's going to help increase testosterone in that animal.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily increasing testosterone because testosterone comes from the testes or the testicles, and that's where all the other stuff happens. But sure, let's say that there is more testosterone in the velvet than there is the rest of the animal at that time. Sure. I don't think we can make that water soluble and ingest it. I don't think that's how we can increase our testosterone levels. But there's a lot of other claims out there. And it's the same thing as what you hear. Personally, I look at it in the same direction when people are using rhino horn and they're wiping out the rhino for that. You're seeing elk poachers happening now because they go after the elk before the velvet's gone. They're going after the elk when they have the velvet on them. And there was even a whole episode of like Longmire about the whole like elk poaching around antler velvet. I'm not going to say like that's, you know, facts because of course it's a fictional show, but there is an industry for taking these animal parts. Same reason why, you know, in Canada, at least in Ontario, there's like restrictions about the gallbladder of a black bear when you hunt them. You're supposed to remain in the body. From when I took hunter safety course, they may have changed since then. Policies may have changed since then, but I don't think they have.
Find out in a couple months.
You'll find out in a couple months when you take the course. Gallbladder, when I was growing up, was to remain in the cadaver, inside the body of the bear. Not the cadaver, the carcass, so that they can confirm that you didn't cut it out and sell it on the black market. And those things drive me up the wall when I see things like that, whether it's rhino horn or like hummingbird eyelash or what have you. The tongue of certain lizards and such. It's that stuff just bothers me when I see that kind of industry. Because we're like, as much as I want to say, like, in that sense, you're exploiting natural resources, but we're still exploiting natural resources when we're hunting. Like, we're still exploiting a natural resource. Whether the exploitation is in a negative or a positive way is your own ethical questions you got to ask yourself. But yeah, I personally am against the idea of taking antler velvet and trying to turn that into anything marketable. If you're farming elk or you're farming deer, you're taking the antler velvet off, then sure, I can't really argue that, but don't take it from wild animals. Because usually when the animal is in velvet is not when they're legal to hunt.
Well, then there's also the use that I've seen you use and you kind of introduced me to last year was using as a burnishing tool for wood carving for the antlers and everything, crushing that end grade of your carved wood products.
Yeah.
Using all my crookses and my spoons and everything just to really solidify it.
Antler has an amazing way of just like being the perfect, like, I don't want to say Rockwell hardness, but like density that it can really push fiber where you need it to go. There's even like some folks that I've seen make antler awls where they make a channel inside of it, almost like a bird bone. And that channel is where they can do coiled basketry. And they use the antler because it's smoother than bone. And it'll fit between the fibers and not damage or crush fiber when you push it in there to fit that next binding agent in or a binding fiber in to do a coiled basket of the grasses or wild rice or what have you, or sweet grass or pine needle. Really cool. Like, antler is just a really cool material that I feel like I even myself have not explored to its full extent. And I really got to go get some more antler. And the cool thing is, like, if that's one thing that interests you, but you're not necessarily getting into hunting, they drop them every year. Go out in the woods in the springtime and look at like the bottoms of creeks where a deer jumps over that creek. That impact can be enough to make the antlers jar off and fall off. I'll often find them at the bottom of big hills. You go for enough walks in the woods, you'll find deer antler in the springtime. Just as the snow is receding and into April and early May, you can have some good luck finding a lot of antler out there. I know some people that come back with like bucket loads of antler. And because it's a free natural resource. Like, it's the one thing that you can use of an animal that you don't really have to worry about killing or the death of the animal to get. That animal, if you found those antlers on the ground, there's a good chance that animals survived because they don't drop those during the hunting season. And they don't fall off when the animal's starving in winter. It's usually late winter, early spring when they finally drop those antlers. February around here is when I start seeing antlerless deer happening, when I know that they're bucks. It's a unique and important material. So I think the moral of the story of this episode is there's a lot in an animal, and we take that life, and we have to take that life, the taking of that life seriously. And you're not going to get it all. Like, at the end of the day, you're learning. And even some of the best out there leave some behind or aren't able to make use of everything that's on that animal. But if we can strive for that, if we can strive to use up as much as we can and use the whole animal from nose to tail as best as we can, whether it's turning it all into stock or you're processing that into tools and clothing and everything else. And you can learn this stuff down the road. Like, a lot of these things, if you're not sure what to do with it, you can just toss it in the freezer and hold on to it until it's time.
And toss the bones on the roof of your house.
Toss the bones on the roof of your house. The neighbors love it. All my neighbors listening in, you can vouch for me. You love when I have a carcass on the roof. Or hang it in the trees in the woods to let the birds pick it. There's always something you can do with it that's going to benefit the rest of life. The goal is to strive to make as little waste as possible. And if you can do that, you're on the path. Even if you didn't get everything, you're on the path. You're on the right way. So for all those that are hunters, all those that are roadkill pickers, all those that are getting pieces from other hunters or from butcher shops or what have you, learn to use the whole of the animal. Use it all. Try as much as you can and do better. We can all always do better, including myself and the people that taught me. But anyways, this episode is getting well over an hour and a half already. Let's not make this much longer. Thank you all for tuning in. I want to thank people like Paul McCartney, Renee Nolting, Martin Heidinga, and all of our other patrons over at Patreon who've been supporting this podcast. Thank you so much, all of you. And the patron chosen episode is coming up next.